Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the first class in the Discovering Buddhism module, The Wisdom of Emptiness. Did anybody show up last Monday night? I hope not. Okay. We have 5 weeks scheduled for this, but now we're down to 4 weeks, and I think we can do it in 4 weeks. But we may have to rush a little bit through the last class or stay a little bit late, but I think we can squeeze it all in this time. So let's plan on being here for 4 Monday nights. What was the last module? Bodhicitta. Okay, so anybody want to define bodhicitta for me? Someone who took that module? Yeah, the awakened mind. Okay. And what does that mean in English? No, that's what we're talking about in this module. Okay. Yeah. Bodhicitta is the compassion wing of enlightenment, specifically the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all beings. And this module is emptiness, which is the wisdom aspect of enlightenment. To become enlightened, to become a Buddha, we have to be compassionate and wise. Or as Gareth Barham says, you have to be nice and smart at the same time. Just being one or the other isn't good enough. You can't be a dumb, nice person or a smart, mean person. You have to be smart and nice at the same time to be a Buddha. So we have 4 weeks together to work on the smart aspect. Let's see, who here has taken this module before? A number of people. You must have done it a long time ago, yeah. Was I leading it? I think I'm the only person who's taught this module for some reason. There's some that I will not teach, but this and the one on karma and the one on the nature of the mind are the ones that I really enjoy teaching. Okay, so some people have taken it before. Do we have anyone who's here for the very first time at Kadampa Center? Okay. Anyone here who's doing their very first Discovering Buddhism module? Okay, so a number of people. Okay, so just to give you the format, like I said, it's 4 Monday nights. If you're doing it for credit, which means you do the entire 2-year series, and you get a certificate at the end, and then you can be a teacher and sit up here in front of the in front of the class. That's a real motivator, isn't it? Yeah, give me a break. Yeah, we need more teachers. There's homework that you need to complete. You don't have to turn the homework in, but it mostly involves meditating and doing some readings and thinking about the subject. And then there'll be a completion form they'll give out that you can fill out and turn in. And there may be an essay at the end. There's always some sort of completion exercise. It varies upon how the class is going. The required readings for this module and for all the Discovering Buddhisms are on this CD-ROM called Discovering Buddhism. It includes the readings for all 14 modules. And this is for sale. In the bookstore, there's a freestanding little whirly-turning bookshelf in the middle that has the Discovering Buddhism material on it for $20, so it's a real deal. Not required, and I generally don't encourage a lot of outside reading, but highly, highly recommended for this course because it's not just a good book for this course, but it's a good resource, and it's a good book I go back to a lot, is Essence of the Heart Sutra by the Dalai Lama. And, you know, the Dalai Lama is a publishing industry unto himself, and, you know, I don't know if he writes these books or not. You know, a lot of them are transcriptions of teachings, but personally I think they vary in quality, or they're some that I find very useful and some that I find, you know, we're probably just assembled to get something for the publisher to get something out on the market. But this is a really good one, and this is one that I would highly recommend, called Essence of the Heart Sutra, and it's published by Wisdom Publication, which is our an FPMT center that's a publishing house in Boston. So that's for sale out there. And if you want just a general reference book that does include some of the material that we'll be covering in this class, Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand by Pabongka Rinpoche is the kind of the Buddhist Bible, or at least in the Tibetan tradition. It has the teachings in a very organized, scripturally authentic format. It's not the most scintillating reading, but it's a good reference book in that you would use for basically all the teachings that are given in here at Kadampa Center. You can trace back to Pabongka Rinpoche. So this is a wonderful book. And, you know, we tend to think of this, oh, this must have been written centuries ago. You know, this was written in the 20th century by a very great Lama who really embodied the Buddhist tradition as it existed in isolation in Tibet. It was written from teachings he gave. It's a transcription of teachings he gave in the 1930s, I think. Yeah, he died in 41. Okay. Classes run from 7 to approximately 8:30. I start pretty close on time. And end on time, or sometimes a little bit early. We'll be doing some meditation every week, and a lot of discussion, a lot of questions. I'd like to leave a lot of time for questions, particularly on a subject like this. So, if you're new here, bathrooms are outside. I think everybody knows where they are. Any other logistical? Let's see, Chris, if people miss a course, the audio of the teaching of the class will be...
they'll definitely be up on the website if you're a member, you can get them there, and then I try to get them onto the lobby.
Mm-hmm.
So if you miss a class or you want to hear the recording, you can download it as well. Mm-hmm. And put it on your favorite MP3.
Okay. But a great reason to become an official member of Kadampa Center that gives you access to the part of the website that has the audios of basically everything that goes on here at Kadampa Center.
Can you ask a question?
Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, you'll see Susie running around thrusting a microphone in your face because we like to get the questions on the audio also. Okay, any other questions about the general format for the class? Okay. Yes. The homework is on, the readings are on the CD-ROM. They're not put, they're copyrighted and we can't put those up on the website. You have to buy the CD-ROM to get those, okay? Let's see. Let's start with some meditation. I'm going to assume everybody's had a little bit of experience, at least, with meditation. What's the word? What's the Tibetan word for meditation? Gom. So this room is called the Gompa. It's a room for meditation, a place where you meditate. And what's the definition of meditation in the Buddhist tradition? To become familiar with, specifically, studying the mind. But it means to become familiar with something. Okay? Allowing your mind to become familiar with something. So it implies that you've chosen an object for your meditation. You're not just sitting there in the Tibetan tradition and blanking out, trying to have no thoughts. According to the Buddhist, the Tibetan tradition, their understanding of mind, that's a contradiction in terms. You can't have a mind that's completely free of thoughts. You can have one that's free of conceptual thoughts, but the mind, there is always something happening in the mind. It's always changing. It's always perceiving. It's always being aware. So when we meditate, our mind becomes familiar with, becomes aware of, stays concentrated on the chosen object. And there are basically two types of meditation. The first is concentration, where we just place the mind on an object. It could be a sound, it could be an image, it could be an idea, and we just leave it there and we bring it back every time it wanders away. And that's what the type of meditation we'll begin with tonight. Then the next other type of meditation is what we refer to as analytic, where we use the mind's ability to think, reason, remember, understand, to become more familiar with a particular topic or concept, like the inevitability of death, which is something we can very easily give lip service to, but not something that we're really aware of or really understood. So that could be an analytic meditation we might do. And we'll do some analytic meditations later in this course, but probably not tonight. Okay, so we begin by checking our posture. The posture is based on the Tibetan concept of the winds, the energy channels that the consciousness or mind is said to ride on, like a rider on a horse. The mind travels on these winds. They're not anything physical that can be seen if we dissect the body, but they follow the Hindu concept of the chakras, or the energy nodules or nodes within our body. So the posture is built upon first opening up the wind channels so our mind can ride freely, which in more practical terms means the posture is stable, non-distracting. It's not supposed to be painful or excruciating. If that's what's happening, you need to find a different posture. But the first thing is to make sure that your back is a little bit straighter than you normally sit. Not rigid, but so that you can imagine these energy channels that are in front of and to each side of the spine are nice and straight and open. Said the posture is a little bit regal. And then, so once we've done, and to do that, if you're sitting on a cushion, it's good to sit on the front third of the cushion. Don't sit back so you're leaning back, but sit a little bit to the front. If you're sitting in a chair, don't lean back in the chair, but sit on the seat of the chair, and it's fine to put a cushion under your feet if they don't reach to the floor in these chairs. Okay, so then starting from the top, our head is straight on our shoulders, maybe just a couple degrees in front of the vertical. But again, we imagine the energy channels from the crown chakra at the top of the head traveling down in front of and each side of the spine down to the level of the navel, and then ultimately down to the level of the genitalia. So that's nice and straight. Said it's best for our eyes to just be very slightly open, just so that a little bit of light comes in. But if you find that distracting, it's fine to just close your eyes loosely. Our jaw is relaxed, not clenched. Our tongue is on the back of the upper gums above our teeth. Again, our shoulders are down and a little bit back, so the chest is a little bit open, keeping the chakras straight and the energy channels straight. Upper arms a little bit away from the sides of the body. Right hand on left with thumbs touching, slightly below the level of the navel. And then in our legs in a position that we find comfortable. Can either be a full lotus, half lotus position, what's referred to as a cobbler's position with the one foot on the ground in front of the other, or crossed or whatever we do. But the idea is the pelvis is a little bit open and stable. So just take a second and scan the posture. If you find any sources of tension or muscle pain right now, address those now so that it doesn't become a distraction during the meditation. And having established the posture, we'll begin the meditation, as always, by setting our motivation. Being very deliberate and intentional about the reason for doing this meditation. If you're just doing it out of curiosity, That's fine. If you're doing it because it helps you relax, that's great. If you find it relieves stress, wonderful motivation. But said that the highest motivation for doing a meditation like this, for studying the teachings of the Buddha, discussing them, thinking about them, the highest meditation is, as we mentioned earlier, the bodhicitta motivation. That I'm doing this meditation to change my mind in a way so that I can be of more benefit to others. I'm doing it for myself, but also for my family, my friends, my coworkers, strangers, even the people I don't like. I'm doing this meditation so that I can be of benefit to everyone. So it may not seem natural to think that way. It may seem very artificial, and that's fine. But just think that way for a moment. And having set our motivation, we now begin the meditation. First, we'll take just a couple deep breaths to settle the mind a little bit farther, a little bit more. Not to put us to sleep. We want to stay alert, but concentrated, undistracted. So take three deep breaths through both nostrils with the stomach expanding on the in-breath. So the diaphragm is pulled down and the lungs are completely filled. And then the stomach contracting on the out-breath. Do that three times. And now you allow your breath to return to its normal pattern. And in this simple, but not easy, concentration meditation, we are just going to place the mind on the breath. The mind becomes familiar with the breath. The physical sensation of the breath moving in and out through our nostrils. We're not describing it to ourselves. We're not thinking about the breath. We're not even counting the breaths. But direct, non-dualistic experience of the movement of the breath through the nostrils. We can almost say that the mind and the breath are of the same nature as we do this meditation. mind perceives nothing but breath. And every time we notice that the mind has wandered off to another object, to a sound, or a physical sensation, or a memory, or thought about something we need to do tomorrow, we just set that aside very gently and bring the mind back to the breath. Over and over and over and over again. And that is the meditation. The mind concentrating on the breath. And we'll end our meditation with a dedication. Acknowledge that we've done something positive just by sitting like this for a few minutes. We've become a little bit more familiar with how our mind works, with concentration. And may that positive imprint that we've made on our mind stream ripen in a way to benefit all living beings. Any questions or comments about that meditation? I think most people are familiar with it, are getting pretty good at it. Okay. I'm going to give just some general introductory remarks about the material that we'll be covering in this course. The real name, the full name of this module is The Wisdom of Emptiness. And frequently you'll hear the phrase around here, the wisdom that realizes emptiness or the wisdom that understands emptiness. And when we use the word, what do we mean by the word wisdom in the Buddhist tradition? What does that refer to?
Knowledge
of what? Knowledge of it. We're in a circle here. We may not get out of it, yeah. Yeah, wisdom means seeing reality as it is, seeing things directly without conceptions, misconceptions, interpretations, seeing things as they truly exist. And there's a lot of jargon that we'll have to wade through in this course. According to the teachings of the Buddha, the way things really exist is that they are empty. And what does that mean? First thing is make sure when you hear that you always remember that the Buddha is not saying that things don't exist. Okay? That's referred to sometimes as nihilism, as going off the cliff on one end. Okay? At the other end is seeing things as existing inherently. Permanently, again, this is just a lot of words right now, we'll work our way through in this class, from their own side, without cause. Okay, a very solid, graspable nature. Okay, on the one end we have the misconception that things don't exist at all. On the other end, we have the misconception that things exist inherently, neither of which is correct. And so the Buddha was like Goldilocks. He said, right in the middle is the place to be. Things exist, but they don't exist the way we think they do. And by things or phenomena, I'm referring to physical objects, people, our mind, our emotions, our ideas. The nature, even enlightenment, even the Buddha. Everything, according to the Buddha, is empty of inherent existence. Okay, which is not saying they don't exist, but saying they don't have this kind of existence that we think they have. The Buddha says we go through life misperceiving everything. It is so much a nature of the way we think and interact with ourselves and the world around us that we don't even know it. It's like we're in the city of Oz and we have green glasses on, green tinted glasses. We don't realize that. We see everything as green and we believe that it's green. So the Buddha's saying we misperceive the way things exist and we believe in our misperceptions and we don't even know that we're not perceiving things. So what we have to do, according to the Buddha, is take these false glasses off, get rid of this faulty way of seeing reality. Because that misperception of reality is the source of all our problems. Every bit of unhappiness, every bit of suffering we have, according to the Buddha, is a result of not seeing things as they truly exist. So if we want to be free of suffering, if we want to be free of unhappiness, we have to see reality as it exists. Okay? So that's what the wisdom realizing emptiness, the wisdom that understands emptiness, is all about. It's seeing things reality as they exist, first in an order to remove your own problems, and then to see how other people are suffering in the same way, and through developing compassion, being able to help them. Okay? So a person who's developed that quality, who has seen reality as it is, has seen the emptiness of all phenomena, what's that person called? Anybody know what the term? That's an arhat. Yeah. Okay. And just to get a little bit of terminology out of the way, this is a Sanskrit term. An arhat. That's someone who's seen the emptiness of all phenomena. They're not a Buddha, okay? But they're free of personal suffering, okay? They've eliminated personal suffering. So they're the really smart person, okay? They haven't necessarily developed the compassion aspect, so they may not be nice, but they're smart, okay? So they're at least halfway there. And in the traditional presentation of the path, you work on this part first, okay? Getting rid of personal suffering, so then you can be of greater help to others. You have to get your own act together to some degree before you can help others. So, of course, you know, when people study Buddhism, they're studying teachings on emptiness and teachings on compassion all at the same time. But the traditional presentation of the path is that you eliminate personal suffering, then you develop compassion. Okay? So the two necessary qualities to become a Buddha, to become completely enlightened, are wisdom, seeing reality as it is, and two, compassion, the wish to help others. So those are the two wings of the bird of enlightenment. So you have to develop both qualities. This class we're talking about developing wisdom, seeing reality directly, leads to complete cessation of personal suffering. Okay? Any questions or comments?
Is there anybody living now that's considered to be an arhat, like, for example, the Dalai Lama?
Well, you know, a lot of people say the Dalai Lama is a Buddha. He says he's a simple monk. I mean, supposedly there are countless arhats, countless Buddhas in existence, but they don't necessarily go around with a label or proclaiming that. So, I mean, but the teaching is, yeah, there are lots of people out there, yeah, who have developed that quality, who see things as it, don't have this misperception. Yeah, you want to pass the mic?
Why would it make more sense that you develop or understand emptiness before you would understand compassion?
Well, like I say, most people are working on both, but the idea is if you understand why you are suffering, then that naturally leads to an understanding of why other people are suffering. You really can't understand others' suffering until you understand your own suffering, is the way the Buddha taught it. Okay? And if you see how your own suffering comes from not seeing reality, then you can see how the suffering of others comes. It's just a way of being more in tune with what causes suffering in everyone. But you know, it's going to be different paths for different people. Some people may work exclusively on the compassion aspect first. There's no law on that. I'm just saying that's the traditional sequence. Yeah, if you're working on compassion, you're a dumb person, yeah. If you're working on wisdom, you're a mean person, yeah. Yeah. Okay? Yeah.
If you establish yourself as an arhat and you had developed that level of wisdom,
mm-hmm.
is it not like sort of instantaneous that level of compassion would be there? Like it's a separate kind of step. Like it seems like two wings, two things, that two areas to work on. It almost seems like if you had that perfect wisdom, you would have an understanding of compassion.
I think that's correct. Yeah, they really, it's not like you're developing one in isolation. They're really just flip sides of the same coin. Now, this is in the Mahayana tradition, which is the Buddhism of Tibet, China, Japan, Mongolia, Vietnam, even into Afghanistan. Those are all the Mahayana tradition, translates as the greater vehicle, which is not just personal liberation, which is, what's that? What is personal liberation? What's the term for that? Nirvana, okay. That's not the same thing as enlightenment. That's personal liberation from suffering. That in the Mahayana tradition, you go on, develop bodhicitta, and you achieve true enlightenment. In the Theravada traditions of Southeastern Asia, I'm not an expert, so I may be saying this wrong, but for them, the goal is nirvana, okay? In fact, some of those traditions actually say it's not it's impossible to become enlightened, okay? That there was a Buddha, but that's not a possibility for the rest of us. The greatest thing we can achieve is nirvana, the end of personal suffering. So it's a difference in the two traditions, the Southeastern Asian versus some more Northern Asian ones. But don't quote me on that because I'm not an expert on Hinayana or Theravada Buddhism.
But like for Tibetan Buddhism, I mean, They clearly say like an arhat is different than a Buddha.
Yeah, mm-hmm. An arhat is a preliminary say. If you've developed an understanding of emptiness, you're an arhat. If you've developed great compassion, you're a bodhisattva, okay? But those are both Buddhas in training. Those are great achievements, but they're not Buddhahood.
But if you've achieved, like, perfect wisdom, I mean, you wouldn't have a perfect understanding of compassion?
We're talking about these states that I'm not familiar with. I think they really go hand in hand a lot more than you would get from just reading the teachings.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I just want to give you a general frame for the material we'll be covering in this class. We're going to be working on the wisdom side, but we'll touch on compassion. Okay, who can give me a 60-second rundown of the life of the Buddha? Anybody? Paul, you want to take a stab at it? When did he live? A long time ago. Right answer. Yes. About, yeah. Where did he live?
India.
Yeah, in India. Where in India? Which part of India? Yeah, northern India, yeah. Up in the area in between India and Nepal, northern India and Nepal. Okay, and what was his family situation like when he was born? And there's a prince. He had a beautiful wife. He had handsome children. He was handsome himself. He was athletic. He was, he was a winner by all external standards. But at some point he said, this is not enough. This is not satisfactory. And according to the tradition, he left in the middle of the night without saying goodbye to anyone and went out to achieve whatever he felt was missing in his life. And initially he spent 6 years living in a very ascetic lifestyle, mortifying the flesh. And found that useful, but it did not lead to what he wanted. So then he sat down under the Bodhi tree in the town of Bodh Gaya in northern India and just worked with his mind and looked at his mind, and he completely developed his compassion, his characteristics of compassion and wisdom, and became enlightened. He was just an ordinary human being. He was not a god. He was a human being who worked with his own mind and became enlightened. And so what did he do for the rest of his life after that? He taught, okay? He wasn't a god. He couldn't go around relieving people of their suffering or doing miracles or anything. All he could do, which is all a Buddha can do, all an enlightened being can do, they want people not to suffer, but they cannot take their suffering away. They can teach. They can share with them their own experience. This is what worked for me. Give it a try. See if it works for you. Don't do it because I'm telling you to. I'm not a god. I'm just a human being, okay? But this is my experience. So the Buddha taught for the rest of his life. What was the first teaching he gave? Anybody know that? Hmm? Four Noble Truths, exactly, okay? So, what was that first, what do we refer to that first teaching as? It was at Deer Park, but how do we refer to it? First turning of the wheel. Yeah, first turning of the wheel of Dharma. And he taught the Four Noble Truths. Why are they called noble? You may leave. They're truths for a noble being, which means someone who's trying to improve themselves, okay? These are not truths that are immediately apparent to somebody who's just living for wine, women, and song or whatever. Okay? They're for someone who's trying to improve their mind. Truth for a noble being. First one is truth of suffering, often referred to as life sucks. Okay? Life is difficult. Life is problematic. Life doesn't work out the way we want it to be, okay? The word suffering is kind of loaded, but life is full of problems, okay? Yeah, dukkha or dukkha, yeah, D-U-K-H-A, I think, yeah. And the second truth is there's a cause of suffering, and what are the causes? Yeah, what do you call those? Yeah, afflictions, okay? An afflicted mind, okay? A mind that is afflicted by grasping, anger, and primarily ignorance. Ignorance being the opposite of wisdom. Ignorance, seeing things incorrectly. That's the causes of all our suffering. If we don't want to suffer, we got to get rid of the causes, okay? In the Buddhist point of view, everything is caused. Nothing just happens randomly. Okay, what's the third truth? There's an end, okay? Yeah, there's an end. No, the path is number four, okay? Third one is that there is an end, okay? This is where it gets a little less gloomy. It is possible to completely eliminate suffering, okay? Personal suffering. And the fourth is the path. And what's the path? Lots of times you hear it referred to as the Eightfold Path, and I can never remember the Eightfold Path, so I will conveniently cheat. Right view, right thinking, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Okay. Number four is traditionally presented as the Eightfold Path, but actually, according to the Mahayana tradition, he actually mentioned 37 different paths as the subdivisions of that last, as the last of the Noble Truth, and they fall into two major categories. The first is about developing single-pointed concentration, okay, or tranquil abiding, calm abiding. This is a lot of terms. I'm just kind of throwing these out so you kind of see where they fit in the path. What's the Sanskrit term for calm abiding? No, that's the shunyata. Yeah, shunyata. Yeah, not shunyata. Shunyata. S-H-A-N-U-T-A. I'll write that down. Yeah, samadhi is another mental characteristic. Yeah, shunyata. That's calm abiding. Where your mind is, you develop concentration, your mind is just on a single object, doesn't move, and it's incredibly pleasurable, okay? Calm abiding. And then the second part of the last one is referred to as penetrative insight, okay? Insight. You hear a lot about insight meditation in this country. And what's the Sanskrit word for that? Anybody know? Vipassana, yeah. And I know I'm going to spell that wrong, yeah. Vipassana, but that's penetrating insight. Okay, but that's just another way of dividing this last one. If you say Eightfold Path on a quiz, you'll get credit for it. That's good enough. So that was the first turning of the wheel. Okay, and let's see. Oh, here's the eraser. Okay, his first major teaching or group of teachings. He taught this many times, it's just not one time. And then the second turning of the wheel. Anybody know what he taught in the second turning of the wheel? Second major group of teachings? Anybody want to take a guess at it? What the subject was? Yeah, the Vinaya, okay. Yeah, he taught the Vinaya. That's, yeah, the rules for monks and nuns. Yeah. And he also taught a group of teachings called the Prajnaparamita. Second turning of the wheel. Anybody know what Prajnaparamita means? Prajna means perfection. Paramita means wisdom. The perfection of wisdom teachings. Okay, so he's teaching about seeing reality, about personal liberation, about personal freedom from suffering. And then, according to the Mahayana tradition, there was a third turning of the wheel. Some traditions deny that. And the third turning of the wheel was teaching commentary on the Prajnaparamita and then the teachings on Bodhicitta. Okay? Just a little bit of background, because you'll hear those terms used a lot. Okay, so just a little out, and then he died. The end. Okay, after he gave his teachings. So how many teachings did the Buddha give while he was alive, supposedly? 84,000, yeah. Okay, and what are they called? Sutras, yeah. And what language are they in? Some are in Sanskrit, and some are in Pali, yeah. When were they written down? Some were written down fairly soon after the Buddha died, supposedly. I mean, who knows? Some were written 200 to 400 years later. Okay, but they were not exactly, it was not like somebody was sitting there taking notes and transcribing the teachings. So he taught 84,000 sutras. If we take away the Heart Sutra, who here has ever read a sutra? Okay, how many of you read, Paul?
Not that.
Yeah, I mean, you could go to Buddhist teachings all your life and get really great teachings and never read a sutra, okay? Most of them are hundreds of pages long. They're very obscure. They're hard to understand. A lot of them haven't even been translated, okay? Most of them are in these textbooks that we have here all around the altar. You know, you pull one of those out and it's block prints of most of the sutras. So instead of studying the sutras, we'll study commentaries on the sutras, which were written, you know, maybe 600 years later. Or maybe we'll study a commentary on a commentary. But the sutras are surprisingly unimportant in the general study of Buddhism in all the traditions, not just in the Tibetan tradition. But in this class, we are going to read and study the Heart Sutra because it's only 3 pages long. Yes, right on. Yes, and it has been translated, but it's still inscrutable. Okay. And, you know, you say, oh, the Heart Sutra, oh, that sounds so warm and fuzzy, just makes me feel like this. The full title is the Heart of Wisdom Sutra, okay? So it is a wisdom teaching. And in this class, we're just going to go through it line by line, get familiar with it. It's very jargony to some degree, but it covers most of the major points to have an intellectual understanding of what the Buddha was talking about when he was talking about emptiness. And according to the Buddha, emptiness is one of those topics that you have to approach intellectually. Get familiar with the terms, the concepts. That's not the goal. The goal is to ultimately have a direct experience of reality. But we've got these green glasses on that we're not even... First, we have to realize what's there. We have to understand that so we can take them off. So we have to understand our misconceptions before we can get rid of them. So it does seem, it may seem a little bit dry initially, but that's not the goal, is not to have just an intellectual understanding, but to have a deep realization of it. Let's see, I'm going to read something from the Dalai Lama on that. One very important faculty that we human beings have at our disposal to help find happiness and overcome suffering is our intelligence. Our intelligence can help us overcome suffering and find happiness, but our intelligence can also cause problems. Using our intelligence, we can build homes and grow food, but through our intelligence, we can also create anxiety and fear. Our intelligence gives us the ability to remember the past, and it allows us to envision possibilities for the future, both good ones and bad. We cannot truly overcome unhappiness by physical comfort alone. Ultimately, the unhappiness created by human intelligence can only be alleviated by intelligence itself. Therefore, using our intelligence appropriately is essential. And then he goes on to say, to do this, we must conjoin our intelligence to a warm, open heart. So that means having the right motivation when we use our intelligence to approach the subject initially. So, next thing I would like to do is pass out the text of the Heart Sutra. It's not the best copy. The drum was running out of ink. But there are two pages, if you make sure everybody gets one of those. Thank you. You've got one page, he's got the others. Okay, so, yeah, make sure you get everything. And the Heart Sutra is something that they recite nonstop in the monasteries in Tibet, in Japan, and the monasteries that they have in China and Mongolia. It's just something that they'll start reciting at the drop of a hat, because all the monks and nuns have it memorized from when they're very young. So each week we're going to read this out loud together, just so we get a little bit familiar with the text. We won't understand it right off, but we'll be familiar with it and help explain it a little bit later. Okay, everybody got both pages? Let's see. I think we missed someone. First page or second page? Okay. She is empty of second page right now. Okay. Everybody else get both pages? Okay, so let's read this together. Don't worry about understanding it. We'll read it in the same rhythm now, but when we get better at it, we'll let everybody get to their own speed, so you get kind of this rumbling sound, which is really neat when people are reading the Heart Sutra together. So we'll start with, thus have I once heard. Thus have I once heard. The Blessed One was staying in Rajgir at Vulture Peak along with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. And at that time, the Blessed One entered the meditative absorption on the varieties of phenomena called the appearance of the profound. At that time also as well, the noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, clearly beheld the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom itself, and saw that even the five aggregates are empty of intrinsic existence. Therefore, through the Buddha's inspiration, the Venerable Shariputra spoke to the noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, and said, how should any noble son or noble daughter who wishes to engage in the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom train? When this had been said, the holy Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, spoke to the Venerable Shariputra and said, Shariputra, any noble son or noble daughter who so wishes to engage in the practice of profound perfection of wisdom should clearly see this way. They should see perfectly that even the five aggregates are empty of intrinsic existence. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is not other, emptiness is not other than form. Form too is not other than emptiness. Likewise, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness are all empty. Therefore, Shariputra, all phenomena are emptiness. They are without defining characteristics. They are not born. They do not cease. They are not defiled. They are not undefiled. They are not deficient, and they are not complete. Therefore, Shariputra, in emptiness, there is no form, no feelings, no perceptions, no mental formations, and no consciousness. There is no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, and no mind. There is no form, no sound, no smell, no taste, no texture, and no mental objects. There is no I element, and so forth up to no mind element, including up to no element of mental consciousness. There is no ignorance, there is no extinction of ignorance, and so on up to no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. Likewise, there is no suffering, origin, cessation, or path. There is no wisdom, no attainment, and even no non-attainment. Therefore, Shariputra, since bodhisattvas have no attainments, they rely on this perfection of wisdom and abide in it. Having no obscuration in their minds, they have no fear, and by going utterly beyond error, they will reach the end of nirvana. All the bodhisattvas, too, who abide in the three times, attain the full awakening and of unexcelled perfect enlightenment by relying on this profound perfection of wisdom. Therefore, one should know the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unexcelled mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra that quells all suffering, is true because it is not deceptive. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is proclaimed. Tayata, gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisoha. Shariputra, the bodhisattva, the great being, should train in the perfection of wisdom in this way. Thereupon, the Blessed One arose from that meditative absorption and commended the holy Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva, the great being, saying, this is excellent. Excellent, excellent, O noble child. It is just so. It should be just so. One must practice the profound perfection of wisdom just as you have revealed, for then even the Tathagatas will rejoice. And the Blessed One uttered these words, the Sariputra, the holy Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, along with the entire assembly, including the worlds of gods, humans, Asuras, and Gandharvas, all rejoiced and hailed what the Blessed One had said. Okay. So not self-explanatory, I don't think. Maybe somebody has some great insight into it. But we'll go through this line by line over the next 3 weeks and make a little bit of sense out of it. One of the nice things about this one, it kind of has a little bit of a story to it. You've got a setting and you've got some characters, and it's describing an event that supposedly took place during the lifetime of the Buddha. So the setting is Rajgir at Vulture Peak. And I always ask this because I know Chris has been there. Anybody else been to Vulture Peak? It's a pilgrimage site in India. It's an actual place that you can go and visit. You want to give us a little description of it? Yeah.
Now that's irony right there.
Okay. So you're driving around incredibly dirty northern India, and then you decide to go to Vulture Peak where, like, that's it. That's like Daytona Speedway, if you're... And you get there, and there's this incredibly long walk. It's long. You go up and up and up and up and up, and then there's this little bitty peak of this one mountain. And it's not bigger than this room. It's like half of this room, maybe. It might even be smaller than that. And you're looking out over a valley. Everything's covered with trees. And that's just where it happened, just right there.
How high is it?
I think there are peaks around it that are higher, which I really didn't understand.
Yeah.
But it does like stand out in the middle of this valley.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing I remember.
And is it just bare dirt on the top?
No. Right now, there's like a piece of pad of concrete with benches, so you can sit there and have a puja if you're with Venerable Rabina, or have a lunch, or it's
okay. Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
It gave me goosebumps.
Yeah.
I get goosebumps just thinking about being there when I read this, which I put on the floor.
Yeah. So you can go online and see pictures of Vulture Peak. Yeah. Are there vultures there?
I was looking for vultures. I didn't see any, but maybe at one time there were vultures, you know, circling around because it seems like it's in the middle of this wooded valley. There's trees everywhere, and there could be, like, dead things, and vultures would come and eat.
Or any pilgrims who get left behind by Venerable Rabina, get kicked off the pilgrimage for bad behavior. Okay. So, are there room for all the bodhisattvas and on top of this peak?
That's one thing. When you read this, it's like...
According to this, there are thousands of people on this peak.
Right.
Yeah, or beings. Yeah, so we're dealing with
a little bit.
When I
read this, I'm thinking of, like, Carter Finley. Is that the name of it? The stadium. Not this little bitty top of a mountain. But, you know, some of them don't even have formed bodies, I think. I think that's the key.
Yeah. Or a little bit of poetic license, at least, okay? But just to help set the scene, the Blessed One, that's the Buddha. Okay. So he was staying in Rajgira, which is what the area, that area is referred to as Rajgira, and at Vulture Peak, along with a great community of monks. These are the monks who traveled with him as he gave his teachings. There are a lot of monks who just followed him around. There's a community of monks that developed him, and a great community of bodhisattvas. Okay. Bodhisattva is, someone who's developed bodhicitta, okay, who's realized the compassion wing, okay. So there are a lot of beings there. We assume human in human form, maybe, but we don't know. But bodhisattvas were there also. So the Buddha was there with his ordinary monks who were getting the teachings from him, and also with these kind of special people, the bodhisattvas. So they were all there. And whether, you know, there's probably some overlap and whether they had name tags on as to which team they belonged to or not, I don't know. Okay? And the Blessed One entered meditative absorption, so he was meditating. So we're not going to go into it any more tonight because I want to do a little bit more meditation. But that's the setting. On top of Vulture Peak, the Buddha is sitting there in meditation, and with him are all the monks who travel with him and a lot of bodhisattvas. Okay, and the Buddha is sitting there in very deep meditation on this peak in northern India. So that's kind of the setting for what's going to unfold. So, any questions or comments about what we've covered so far? I just want to give people some of the general structure and how this sutra fits into the teachings of the Buddha, the two wings, the wisdom and compassion. Yeah. Well, technically he was a bodhisattva, but a lot of these so-called bodhisattvas were also Buddhas too. But they were identified. Yeah, I'll talk about that a little bit next week. Yeah, it's confusing because, you know, we see all these, you know, we refer to these images as bodhisattvas, but they're actually, you know, said to be aspects of enlightenment. So the term is used a little loosely. Yeah, that's confusing. Yeah. So whether these bodhisattvas were other Buddhas or just bodhisattvas, we'll talk about next week. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Okay. So let's do another meditation, another simple meditation. Again, we're just going to do a concentration meditation. You can let all the talking just slide away. Check your posture. The back nice and straight so the energy channels are open. And then work from the head down, checking every aspect of the posture, working out any problems now. Three deep breaths from the abdomen. And set your motivation, generating as much as possible the bodhicitta motivation. And having set your motivation, now begin your meditation. The mind directly perceiving the breath, the physical sensation of breath moving in and out through the nostrils. Nothing more, nothing less than that. Mind and breath of the same nature even. Every time the mind wanders away, we bring it back over and over. And you can wind down your meditation and do a brief dedication of the positive energy that you've created. Okay. I'm going to pass out the homework. Read the first little section in the reading material here. I'd like people to recite the Heart Sutra out loud every day, just so you get familiar with the words, the rhythm. Don't worry about trying to understand it, but just see how certain words recur over and over. And then do 15 minutes of meditation 6 days out of the week. And then there's a topic to just think about. And then next week we'll start our exegesis of the Heart Sutra and get through it in 3 weeks. We can do it. Any questions before we break up? Okay, thank you. And I'll see you all next week. Yeah. Okay. And let's see, somebody going to be manning the bookstore out there if people... Okay, thank you. Thank you, Susie. Yeah, if you want to buy a copy of the book, again, yeah, Susie will help you at the cash register if you need help. Okay, thank you. Oh, is that tomorrow night? Oh, okay.